All right, as we've read through the book of Job together and listen in to the conversations back and forth, we have the benefit of one conversation that the other characters in the book don't have the benefit of hearing. We've heard what's been said between the adversary and God. That part of the conversation, as we listen into the others, we've been left with a whole stack of questions. We might summarize it like this. Why is there evil in the world? Why is there suffering that happens in the life of people who don't seem to have done anything to deserve it? Is there justice in the way that God rules over His world? Are there misleading doctrines and ideas and thoughts claims that people make that need to be corrected, and all of that kind of thing? And is God's attention to His world, does it extend to the personal experience of individuals like Job? Does God, in ruling over all things, does He have room for little things like me or you? All of those questions have been raised in one way or another as we've read through this book. And so we have been especially interested in having the whirlwind pull up here and having God begin to answer. And that is the way it says it. Notice chapter 38 at verse 1. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind. When I read that, I thought, oh, finally, we're about to get some explanation about these things. But God's answers are questions. And that's the strange thing. God, are there bigger questions in life or in the world that allow us to accept the fact that we don't know all the answers to these questions and still to depend on God? That's the odd thing. Now, what's happened is that God has just said to Job, all right, I want you to line up here. You've been asking all these questions. I'll question you, Job 38, verse 3. And we won't go back over all of what we've already read again, but long story short, what God has done is to start with creation and to show His power over the inanimate world that He's made. God draws the boundaries between the land and the ocean. God creates the sun and the moon and the stars, and they sing over Him. God creates all of the things that you and I take for granted. And then God turned His attention to His providence. And that is sustaining the life of the animate world. All the way from when the mountain goat brings forth her young, to how the ravens find their food, to how come a bird can outrun a horse, an ostrich can outrun a horse. All of those things are in God's providence, and in this case, we have dealt with God's knowledge or His understanding. Now notice carefully, He's taken two chapters, and He's answered, and He hasn't said a thing about Job's situation, or why there's evil, or why there's suffering, or if there's justice, or any of that. Not one thing that either Job or any of his friends have said is specifically responded to in Job chapters 38 and 39. Are you disappointed?
Not yet.
Well, let me help us then. I can disappoint us. The next part of it is...
Yeah.
The next part of it is you. Look at chapter 40, verses 1 and 2, please. Job 40, verses 1 and 2. And I want you to ask yourself, what is the point here that God is making to Job How does chapter 40, verses 1 and 2, attach to what's been said in verses in chapters 38 and 39? Randy, read for us, please.
Then the Lord said to Job, "Will the fault finder contend with the Almighty? Let him who reproves God answer it."
All right, now, what is the question that's being raised here? Is it just whether Job has the power to create and sustain, or is the question deeper than that?
Deeper.
It's deeper, isn't it? What, in your words, is the question that he's asking Job?
Job, are you trying to correct me?
All right. That's exactly the point. Let's put it this way. Are you in a position, and I'll take the time to write this out here, to make a moral judgment about God's rule or God's sovereignty, which is what's happened in this book? Job has said that he is squeezing the life out of me without cause. That what is happening to me, there is no moral reason to have brought about this kind of suffering. And of course, his friends have been implying that if Job would make the necessary moral corrections, then God would come to his aid and bring him through this. And the idea is that Job has been calling out for God to answer. Let me take you back to a couple of places that I can remember offhand here. Where this has been raised. If you go back to chapter 31 for a moment, and notice verse 35. "Oh, that I had one to hear me. Here is my signature. Let the Almighty answer me. Oh, that I had the indictment written by my adversary." Notice there that what Job is insisting on is that God, that he's innocent and that God needs to answer his claims or to answer his charge about that. Then if you notice a little farther, let me find another one if I can real quick here. I may not find it as quickly as I thought I could. All right. In chapter 17, is it? No, it's not. It's not the one I want. Chapter 13, at verse 18, you'll notice the same idea again. "Behold, I have prepared my case. I know that I shall be in the right. Who is there who will contend with me?" And then he goes further. He says to God, "Only two things grant me. The first one is withdraw your hand from me." Verse 21. "The second one is, then call and I will answer, or let me speak and you reply to me." All right, you see, that's what Job has been insisting so far now. And God has answered Job without saying anything about his moral rule of the universe or about his justice. What are we to infer from that? What are we meant to learn from chapter 40 and verse 2 about the dilemma of this book?
Don't get smart aleck with God.
All right, that boils it down to the nub, doesn't it? And the reason would have to be that God is great enough in the obvious world for us to be able to trust him in what we can't see, in the moral realm. And that would be the idea. In creation and providence, God proves to be powerful and knowledgeable. Therefore, in the moral realm, we have good reason to believe that God will do what is best. That is the thought here. And if you look at the questions that are here, the problems that Job has gone close to in his own life and his own behavior or claims in this book is that he has gone past struggling with his suffering, or past responding to his friends, to suggesting that he is in a position to contend with the Almighty. You notice the part of what I just read from chapter 13? I want God to come and contend with me. I want him to answer me. I will be in the right when he does. And his arguing with God in that sense is the fault that Job has confronted in his behavior here. Now, in the way we have this laid out here before us, what would have been the proper response of Job at this point? In other words, why does the book not end at chapter 40 and verse 2?
God's going to make it right.
All right. In the first place, there are some things that God wants to correct. And among those things
is Job.
That's right. He, and certainly his friends, but he wants Job. There is something that God wants of Job. I think that's where I'm headed with this. And if you look at the thought here, I have no explanation right here of why there's evil, why there's suffering, when justice will take place, any of that. All I have at this point is a greater appreciation for the power and the wisdom of God. But I also have the tendency of man to become critical of God's sovereign rule in his world. What will I do now in resolving this situation? Will I have to have an answer from God, or will I have to say, well, I can see that God's power and wisdom, that by all rights, I should humble myself before his power and wisdom, and I should trust him, and I should be loyal to him. Now, that doesn't mean it'll be easy, but it does mean that I at least want to refrain from accusing God or making it look like I am more righteous than he is. All right, now look at what Job says in verses 3 through 5. Scott, read that for us, please.
Then Job answered the Lord and said, "Behold, I am of small account. What shall I answer you? I lay my hand on my mouth. I have spoken once, and I will not answer. Twice, but I will proceed no further."
All right, now, what has Job done at this point? All right, what he says is, if you look at him, first, Job says, "I am of small account." Meaning what? Alright, compared to whom? Alright, compared to God, Job can see, "I am of small account." Second thing he says is, "I lay my hand on my mouth." Meaning what?
be quiet.
All right, I'll be quiet. I'm silenced now. And third thing is, he says, I will not answer. All right. Now, you look at those three things together. Does that equal up to the kind of humility that God desires out of man?
Helps.
It helps. It's a good start. But what, look back to chapter 38 and verse 1. And tell me why God is not satisfied with this response from Job. And why? And then I have probably another why after that.
Job never says he's wrong.
All right, Job, you went straight to my second why, Brendan. The first why is that God, when God pulled up in the whirlwind, he said, all right, now, what has Job not done in verses 4 and 5? All right, he's talked about himself.
I'm not sorry.
All right, I'm a small cat. I lay my hand on my mouth. I'll not answer. But he doesn't say, I'm sorry. And he does not say anything about God. He does not confess God's power and God's wisdom. And when you say of yourself, I am of small account, I won't answer, and so forth, without acknowledging God and recognizing God, then you act like a pouting teenager who has been treated unfairly but can't do anything about it. And Job is sort of in that position right here. This great and good man who feels like he's been treated unfairly is saying, all right, I won't say anymore. Now, when you're talking to your husband or wife, and they say, all right, I won't say any more, do you feel like everything is resolved? Maybe your husband or wife never said that.
Lay my hand over my mouth.
Which usually means what? It means you're afraid to say anything else, doesn't it?
Well, a lot of times the way that comes out is, whatever.
Okay, that's right. I don't think Job is saying whatever here, but I do think he hasn't gone. Remember what we said is at stake when we started this? What's at stake in Job is not just why do bad things happen to good people, but what's at stake in Job is God great enough for a man to worship him and serve him and be loyal to him through hardship just because because God is who he is? And why this is insufficient is that Job has not yet acknowledged who God is. He's still talking about himself. And I think that's why the book goes on another chapter or two, aren't they?
The picture that I see is, you know, God is this whirlwind, is whirling around, and this voice of God is coming up and saying, okay, who are you to question me? And, you know, the fear and the trembling just washing down into what God wants to do either.
If God wanted to blow him away, he could have, couldn't he?
Yeah.
But God wants understanding, and he wants the heart of Job, I think. That's right. The distance that has been created between God and Job has not been because of God. It's because Job has felt sorry for himself. That's understandable. But he started saying things about God, and now when God's power and wisdom shows up, he has nothing to say about God. That's what has to be remedied now. And so God says to him in verse 6 and 7, what? Job just says, I won't answer. God says, do what? All right, he says, Lord answered Job, you gird up your loins, or as some versions will say it, dress for action. You get up here, you've had a lot to say about my job and running this. You had a lot of questions about how I'm doing things. He says, I will question you. Now, Job invited him to do this, remember? So that's the situation. And then and he says, you make it known to me. All right, now remember all these questions I have written down over here, right? All those questions. God, who hasn't answered those questions, says to Job, you make it known to me. All right, that's going to be quite an undertaking. And maybe verse 8 is pivotal, is one of the pivotal, the pivotal, not pitiful, but pivotal verses in the book. Everybody look at it. Becky, read it for us, please. Verses 8 and 9 of chapter 40.
Will you really, in all my judgment, will you condemn me that you may be justified? Or do you have an arm like God, and can you thunder when the voice like this?
All right, Paul is speaking out of the whirlwind here. In verse 8, there are two questions. The first one is essentially, will you put me in the wrong? It's one thing to say, I don't understand what's happening to me. I don't know if I can handle what's happening to me. It's another thing to say, God is doing this to me and it's not wrong. We are not in a position to know whether God is doing it or someone else is doing it. And then, will you condemn me that you may be in the right? In other words, are you in maintaining your integrity, as Job has done through this book, are you willing, in order to justify yourself, to put me in the wrong? Has God now become a tool to Job that Job uses to justify himself? That is the question that's being raised. Now,
it's nice that we don't have to have that communication with God now.
It's nice that we have more information
now. That we don't have to have evidence of talking to us.
I think a lot of us, I'll speak for myself, still have that communication with God. I don't have near the reason for it that Job had. But when I stand in the hospital and see a little baby suffering, yeah, I still struggle with this.
It still goes on.
Still goes on. Now, we have the resurrection of Jesus and the fact that God has been willing to enter this world on earth and offer his son. And Sister Feeney's right with that. But we still, this is in the Bible because it still is a human problem. Now, I want to survey as quick as I can this next couple chapters here. Look at verse 10. What God does with Job, essentially in verses 10 through 14, is to offer him the opportunity to run the world. Has anything like that ever happened to you? Have you ever, as a critic, been offered the opportunity to do what you were criticizing?
I've been offered.
Okay, you've made the offer to other people, but what has it ever been offered to you? I gave a kid one day at Bible camp several years ago. I gave him my whistle for a day. Of course, I stayed with him and told him whatever he had to blow it and all that kind of thing. And I think he got a different perspective. He wasn't doing, he wasn't critical, but he just wanted to do it, you know. The ways in which this may happen may be a child toward a parent, may be a worker toward the boss, it may be any number of situations like that, but what God says to him is, adorn yourself with majesty and dignity and clothe yourself with glory and splendor. I wonder if Job's still on the ash heap here. And what God offers him, notice carefully, is the opportunity to exert moral authority. Look carefully, verse 11. Pour out the overflowings of your anger and look on everyone who is proud and abase him. Look on everyone who is proud and bring him low. Tread down the wicked where they stand. Hide them in the dust altogether and bow their faces into the world below. Then will I also acknowledge to you that your own right hand can save you. All right, Job, you show me how you can abase the proud and exalt the humble. Now, what problem do you see in doing that? All right, first off, to do that, now, all right, how are you going to do that? Let me offer you some illustrations. God used the Assyrians in Old Testament days to bring judgment upon Israel. The Israelites had gotten proud and unfaithful. God brought the Assyrians to humble them. What did the Assyrians do? They became proud. All right, God brought the Babylonians eventually to bring judgment on the proud Assyrians. What did the Babylonians do? They became proud. All right, so what problem do you have? God uses South Carolina to humble Alabama. What does South Carolina do? You see, I can take it to extremes, I suppose. You see what I'm looking at, don't you? How easy is it to be the moral ruler of the world, of the universe? You know God abases the proud and exalts the humble. But do you know how he does it? No, I don't. All right, what about the wicked here? Tread down the wicked where they stand. Hide them in the dust altogether. In other words, where they stand, right that minute. All right, what happens to life if God strikes down every lie that ever has been told, every hateful word that ever has been spoken, every unkind deed that's ever been worked? God deals with it immediately and strikes the perpetrator down. Where are we all?
Yeah. Children, nobody lived past childhood.
That's right.
Yeah.
There sure wouldn't be any parents either, would there? All right, so you get God's point here, don't you? Now, he uses two great examples here in these next two chapters I wanted to say just a little bit about. They stand for, I think, the two most powerful, two illustrations of greatest power, most awesome and unmanageable beasts or whatever, Behemoth and Leviathan. Notice in chapter 40, verse 15, Behemoth is mentioned. It describes his strength and his power. He eats grass like an ox. His tail is stiff as a cedar. His bones are like tubes of bronze, verse 18. His limbs are like bars of iron. Mountains yield food for him. Lotus plants are his bed and his shelters in the marsh. He's described like that, the river is when it's turbulent, he's not frightened. The Jordan rushes against his mouth. Nobody can really do anything to harm him. On the other hand, there's Leviathan, whom nobody can with a fish hook, whose tongue no one can press with the cord. Nobody can put him on a leash, verse 5. Any hope against him is false. His strength, verse 12, is mighty. Verse 14, no one can open the doors of his face. Around his teeth is terror. It talks about him breathing forth, him sneezing light, and his mouth flaming torches. His nostrils boil out smoke. No weapon that anyone has, a sword or a spear or a dart or a javelin or a club would be to him just like nothing. All of that, man would be powerless against him. Brother Finn.
Is this getting into the prehistoric animals?
All right, it may be. Let's think about it for a second here. And I'll tell you the three biggest guesses that I found. I think they all are guesses. But here are the possibilities. The first one is that these are thought to stand for the hippopotamus and the crocodile, because these are both creatures that are said to inhabit the river and to make the water swirl. Both of them have a strength and a power that would seem invincible to to dwellers on the shore who had nothing but darts and swords and spears or that kind of thing. There are people in more recent times who have suggested that perhaps these are the dinosaurs. And especially in chapter 41, with verses 18 and following, really verses 15 and following, his back is made of rows of shields. They're joined together, they can't be separated and all of that. And there are people who have, I wonder sometimes if we're looking for that. There's also the idea that these are symbolic of the things that are most outside of the power and the control of man. And I've tried to think like what the mythological dragon would be to in some lore, or some of the pictures of the creatures that you've seen to explain the book of Revelation, or some such thing as that. Some of the ancient commentators believed that these were symbolic of the two things in the Genesis 1 and verse 2, the waste and void of chaos and the darkness of chaos. And that the idea here is that God has shown the wisdom and the power to bring order out of chaos in the natural world, and that Job should therefore realize that God has the wisdom and the power to bring order out of chaos, or what seems to Job as chaos, in the moral world. You can do more reading about this idea if you'd like to, but I will say at least that is the point of this. Whichever way you take this, the point is that the wisdom, the power and wisdom that God demonstrated to Job in chapters 38 and 39 are sufficient to bring order out of things that seem to be uncontrollable and unfathomable to Job. I never could say that word. But things that Job can't comprehend right now, that God can bring order and chaos out of that.
And that would fit the point that he's making, I think, very well. Brother Phoenix?
Since God views natural things in the previous chapter, it would seem to me like 1 and 2 would be more natural.
Yes, I personally lean toward the more traditional view here. I'm thinking about how the readers of Job who lived around rivers and seas and so forth. That's right. And I do think that would fit the line of thought better. But even if it does, the idea that God can bring, God can control and bring order out of what no man can fathom or control, including moral dilemma, is the idea that gets pressed home here. The message of this about God to Job, how would this add to what God has already said to Job? What does this add to what Job, how far Job has been willing to go in chapter 40, in verses 2 and 3? How is this a step forward? You notice, and here let me try to offer an answer. Our time is running. Notice that what happens now, this is where this is laid out, God is going to demand not silence from Job, but an answer. So he offers Job the opportunity to run the universe himself. That is, to be the God of the moral world himself. And remember my first little chart we started with? Creation, providence, and you. This would be inanimate world, animate world, and moral world. You run it now. And then he's offered to Job, and Job has the reins in his hand, so to speak, at least in the mental way now. And immediately what confronts Job are the two creatures which no man has been able to tame, Behemoth and Leviathan. Will Job say, maybe I was a bit hasty, you drive this thing? Is Job ready to say that or not? He's getting close. Will he progress beyond, I will lay my hand over my mouth, to I will open my mouth and say, you are God, and I'm ready for you to keep your place in my life? That's where we are now at this book. Now, if the bell would ring right now, it would be perfect, would it?
It's within 30 seconds.
Within 30 seconds. All right, Dan?
In that part of the world where there is hippopotamuses and crocodiles, I think they are still two of the animals that are killed the most people.
Is that right?
Yeah. More people are killed by hippos and crocodiles than are killed by lions. Yeah.
Well, I know that a creature can look frightening to another boy who's just walking along himself, all right?
And along the lines of your at camp with a whistle as a teacher and a professor, one of the most common things you do is give the class to the student who's having difficulties with it. And like you say, see how easy this teaching stuff is.
Yeah. It's like I never, if y'all want to know why I always eat everything on my plate, it's not because I'm just that kind of eater. It's just that I don't want to have to be offered a chance to cook myself, you know. Right? That's the way it works. I do think, though, that the way God taught Job is really important. Does this take Job farther than a specific answer to these questions over here that I had earlier could have taken him? Yes. Yes, it does. Yeah, because any of you parents know that there have been times when your kids had questions that you couldn't explain to them yet. They would have to trust you. And that's what God is doing here.
Last thing is, he allows all these things yet to happen to
us. Yes. But he gave his son, he's raised him up.
We have that
he wants word to be spread. that he's trying to do what ought to be done with those things. All right. Appreciate y'all being with us today. Everybody have a good week.